Coming up on Boston Public Radio, was it a blizzard, a dusting, or a bombogenesis? Regardless, in most cases, schools are closed. We'll ask you whether some communities jumping the gun cause you woes. Hey, baby boomers, want that brain to work better and longer? The woman behind a study of brain games joins us. And then Globe editor Brian McGrory on the latest on sex abuse in the Catholic Church and the possible resurrection of MIT.
Medical ethicist Art Kaplan weighs in on doctors Googling their patients and a new drug that could help us all forget traumatic experiences. Edgar B. Hurry III has solved the mystery of out-of-service buses. And then WGBH arts editor Jared Bowen reviews some new local plays, including The Color Purple, Venus in Fur, and Imagining Madoff. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Say it, Marjorie. Get it out of the way.
Bombogenesis.
Okay, it's been said.
Didn't happen, did it?
Okay, fine. It didn't. Well, actually, on the South Shore. We're kicking
right
off today's show with a dispatch from the desk of, I guess, counterintuitive research, or is it? A new study out of Harvard's Kennedy School finds that snow days do not have a negative effect on kids' learning. In fact, keeping schools open during a storm could actually be more detrimental to learning than shutting schools down altogether. Basically, what the study suggests is that since one of the major challenges teachers face is coordinating students, it's better for the kids in the classroom to have no school rather than a classroom that is half full. It's pretty obvious to me. In any case, parents, teachers, students, what's your take on this? And a second thing I want to put on the table, since many of you are listening to us today from home, in communities with very little snow, hello, Boston, Brookline, Somerville, Cambridge, and beyond, how do you feel about this new practice of closing schools the day before? You know, when we were younger, not so long ago, even 10 years ago, you woke up as parents of kids who were in public schools,
yep,
or private schools, but in schools, and you immediately either, if it went online or pre-computers 20 years ago.
On the TV.
You went on TV or listened to the radio.
You think, okay, if you live in like, Danvers, and they're on Acton, then you can get a few things done before you have to run back to the TV set to catch up between the A, B's, C's, and D's and stuff and wait for your town.
But we're having an impassioned debate from the parents of young kids and teens in the GBH newsroom, and I have to say it is a pitched battle about whether or not this new practice, where people like Marty Walsh stood up yesterday, the new mayor of Boston, who will be with us in the studio, by the way, on the 31st, part of his new monthly visits here to talk to you and to us the last Friday of every month. Marty Walsh declares that schools are closed. Yesterday, mid-afternoon, we wake up and there's virtually no snow. That was the situation. Hillary Sargent, who used to work with us here, is now at Boston.com, wrote a thing that captured this perfectly on Boston.com. OMG, it snowed 4 inches is the title. Boston schools canceled. Hey, kids, you don't have to go to school today. So go out and have fun trying to build snowmen with this 4-inch dusting of snow. And it's really true. I don't quite understand. You know, on some level, well, where are you on this before I tell you where I am?
I'm absolutely wait till the morning of. I'm absolutely, because first of all, your kids don't know, so they have to go to bed early. And that's a good thing anyway, so they're not all out of their sleep cycle thing. And second of all, how many times can you think of that we made the mistake because the forecast didn't turn out to be the way it was supposed to be?
Isn't
we're supposed
it better
to get
to
like
plan?
9 or 12 inches.
So what is the harm of them having made a mistake today, even though it looks a little ridiculous? What's the harm?
Because if you work for a living, as most parents do, including most mothers, this is a real problem. A lot of bosses are not very sympathetic. There's no school. Well, you got to get your rear end into the office.
Marjorie, I've known you long enough to know you complaining when you woke up and at 6 o'clock in the morning, you go, oh, my God, I got to find a place to stuff my kids today. So you were complaining when there was very little notice, and now you're complaining because it's too much notice. If occasionally a mistake is made, What's the big deal?
Usually I stuffed my kids with me and brought them to work is what I did, which was what a lot of people do. But I just think that there are too many times the forecast, and we have great meteorologists, and they were right in a lot of places, we should say.
South Shore and
Cape Cod has got the bombogenesis hit down there. But I mean, what, you know, especially, and Boston, I'm going to give a little bit of a pass to because they have so many kids bust. But Cambridge, Brookline, and Brookline particularly, where they walk to school, most of these kids, I mean, it's just crazy. It's really hard when there's so few moms home, like they used to be in the 50s and 60s, to make little tuna fish sandwiches for the kiddos. Our number is 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Would you rather have the superintendent of schools, who only makes two mistakes, of course, he closes the schools, or he doesn't
keeps
close
them open,
the
right?
Would you rather have the superintendent? It's very stressful for them. Close the schools on the day before, so you have plenty of time to plan, or the morning of, so you don't wake up this morning, as Hillary Sargent wrote, with 4 inches of snow and no school, and you can't even really go sledding because there's not that much snow.
877-301-8970. I also want you to comment on this Harvard Kennedy School thing. I have to say, the results of this study, which I assume cost somebody some money, are so pathetically obvious that I can't believe researchers spent time on this. The issue is it better to have nobody in school, meaning a closed school day, and then make it up later where everybody's in class, or to have schools open where only some of the kids get there and some fall behind? I mean, my response is, duh. I mean, how much more obvious can they be? Of course it is better.
Well, also, did somebody think that a school closing for a day or two actually had a negative effect on kids' learning? I mean, I get the over the summer when you're gone for 10 weeks. But, I mean, if you miss school, if you're in school Monday and Tuesday and you miss Wednesday, you go back on Thursday, you're not going to get into Harvard so you can go make a study at the Kennedy School?
No, but I don't think they were saying – I think they were doing a comparative thing. I don't think they were saying it's the end of Western civilization. But which is better for the education of a child, a total closure on a snow day where no one gets ed and no one falls behind, or an opening where there's only partial attendance because some kids can't get to school? And the pathetically obvious conclusion that the Kennedy School person, whoever did this, came to was it's better to close it for everybody. This guy who did this is not commenting on whether or not superintendents and mayors should close schools the day before or not. But I am telling you, it was this pitched a battle as if we were debating who should be the next United States senator from New Hampshire.
And we were talking about this upstairs with my kids are grown up now, but with people who still have small kids.
Yeah,
and they were saying
that,
the 2-hour delay is often better. An hour delay or a 2-hour delay. So you have time to shovel out. You have time to get, you know, to be proceed cautiously in the roads, drive your kids to school. At least you can go into work and the kids can go into school for the day. Because that's the issue, I think. Everybody's working.
Okay, so let's take Marty Walsh as an example before we get to the calls. Walsh, I think it was roughly 3, 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. He made the declaration that schools are going to be closed. If it turns out we had awakened and instead of there being virtually no snow on the ground in Boston, there had been 15 inches, what would most people say? He couldn't have known this yesterday afternoon, so I could have planned for this eventuality today. The reality is sometimes they're going to be wrong, but in my opinion, it is far better, despite the inconvenience for some parents, it is far better to err on the side of caution in these cases. You don't agree. Most of the people upstairs in the newsroom.
So you're saying the day before?
Yes, I am saying the day before,
I think that's
yes.
crazy. Because too many times it's too hard to predict exactly where there's going to be a ton of snow. I mean,
So they make a mistake. What's the harm? It isn't like they make a mistake every time. If 1 or 2 days a year max, superintendents, mayors, city managers close schools when they didn't have to. Is that the end of Western civilization?
Well, maybe this is a father versus mother thing, because I suspect that a lot of the mothers are the ones that are staying home today taking care of the kids because dad's job is, of course, too important.
Let me tell you,
must go to it.
When my kids were young, I would be the one, I'd take them to a bar, and essentially we just sit there all day watching television, maybe football games, until the end of the day.
Yeah, I would take them to the Herald, and they could make, you know, they get the paper clips, and by the end of the day, they had a paperclip necklace that was 2 blocks long. It was unbelievable.
It's like vocational training.
Exactly.
877-301-8970. Again, how do you feel about this? That it's a fairly new trend. Maybe 10 years that it's been going on, where cancellations are expected to be either decided or not decided, cancellations happen or don't happen the day before.
I know, as opposed
to a while ago when you waited till the morning.
There was always a lot of suspense in my house. So I think it was fairly recently that we were up all night not knowing whether there was school.
It was so recent because I think you were able to go on a computer. I don't think it was pre-computer. I think it was the computer. You went online and you found out whether or not your school system was closed that day.
Okay, let's go to Anne in Swampscott. I hear there's not much snow up there in Swampscott, Anne.
Hey, Anne.
This makes me crazy.
Oh, good.
One of our colleagues is from Swampscott. We won't say who, and he feels the same way you do, Ann. Go ahead.
I'm crazed. I'm just crazed because there's 3 inches of snow out here. But the other thing that makes me nuts about this is that they'll go longer in the year into June, and then we'll hear the complaints that the building is too hot, so the little darlings now have to just play outside all the time. So nothing gets done. I mean, it makes me crazy.
Yeah.
It just makes me crazy.
I can hear it in your
voice.
Now,
is there a big transportation issue in Swampscott?
Everybody walks.
Everybody walks. That's what
I
thought.
Or they're driven, but, I mean.
And mostly they're driven, probably.
Well, yes, they're driven.
We
I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
We're very delicate out here. Very delicate.
So and what is your deal with work? Are you working outside the house normally?
I'm a self-employed CPA, and I had to rebook my entire day. So I'm on the phone last night just rebooking appointments to the following week. And during tax season, this will make me crazy. And then sometimes my husband who has, you know, he has sick days, so we will trade off. We will make the who has the more important day. And that's how we'll negotiate it. That's the best way we can do it.
So are you and your husband going to be picketing the Swampscott superintendent's house this afternoon or no? With
no,
your
I'm
children?
Not gonna pick it. I'm just... It just makes me crazy because we're very delicate out here in the North.
Ann, great call. Thank you so much for making it.
I love the way Ann and her husband make the distinction which person has the more difficult day as opposed to which person has the more important job.
Well, I think Cher's standard's a good one.
Or if you make more money than your spouse, are you the one that goes to work while the one that makes less money stays home kind of thing? I mean, these are always fun for mom and dad relationships, I think. 877-301-8970. What do you think about the Harvard study that says, actually, your child will survive academically if they have a few days off for snow or the
but
fact...
you're misinterpreting the study.
I'm not misinterpreting
yes, you are.
The study.
He's not saying... He's not judging a closed school because mm-hmm. of snow in isolation. He's comparing the damage, albeit probably modest, mm-hmm. of a closed day because of snow as opposed to an open day because of snow where there'll be scattershot attendance. Some come, some don't come.
Yeah.
So that's what he's trying to do.
I just think that this was a solution without a problem.
Well, I agree with that. I think the study is a total waste of time and money, but it's getting huge play and we're participating in the huge play.
Sean from Denham. How are you, Sean? What do you think about the snow situation?
I can tell. Go ahead, Sean.
Jim, you try to free my mind, Jim. What do you think I'm going to say?
I would believe, in light of the fact that I think that the announcement should be made the day before, that you believe that is the most ridiculous thing you have ever heard. Is that a fair assumption?
Mind you, we have problems.
We do, Sean.
On the same page. All right, last night about 6 o'clock, they make the announcement in Dedham. All right, my two little brats aren't going. They couldn't have waited. I was up at 5 this morning thinking that I was going to be, you know, shoveling forever. I literally took a broom and moved the snow to, you know, left and right, and I was done in 10 minutes. Are you kidding me?
I know.
They couldn't have waited.
I'm with you. I mean, they could absolutely wait.
Just wait. Well, and, you know, I love that they're 2 hours away. Let them go in 2 hours later. Jim, when I was a kid and I had to put hot potatoes in my mittens and walk 2 miles up a hill both ways.
Both ways, yeah.
You know, it was like going through the Klondike.
Yeah.
You know, I managed. And look at me now, a better man for it.
And by the way, I would put hot potatoes in my mittens. The difference between you and me, Sean, is I would eat them on the way to school. Sean, thank you for your call, as always.
Now, Art from West Ridgewater has a theory. He thinks it's going to become more and more common for this day before thing. When the governor, as he did yesterday, sends people home before the storm starts and suggests private companies do the same, of course, mayors and superintendents are going to do more and more on the day before snow day call. So, you know, that's the point, too, because, of course, the state of the state was supposed to be given last night by Governor Patrick, and he canceled it. In Patrick's defense, at 7 o'clock last night, the wind was howling and the snow was flying in a horizontal.
Well, and also some people who might have driven in or gone to the speech had to drive to the Cape or the South Shore afterwards.
Yeah, it was bad last night. But, you know, that's true. If the guy that runs the whole state is doing things the day before, maybe everybody else as a politician feels the same obligation to do it, too.
Hillary Sargent wrote about that, too.
Oh, she did. Oh, good.
State of the State speech, canceled. Instead of addressing the future of the Commonwealth yesterday evening, Governor Deval Patrick gave the state what it really craves, a snowstorm press conference, complete with requisite casual snow attire, which for Patrick meant unbuttoning his top shirt button and unbuttoning his blazer. By the way, we should have mentioned the governor will be here
tomorrow.
We can ask him about this.
Usually I've seen the governor in these snow emergencies. He's usually wearing a snappy MEMA vest, the fleece vest. And I think that looks very apropos. He's always dressed for the occasion. Have you noticed that?
He's a very well-dressed
guy. Brandon in Worcester. What do you think, Brandon?
I think it should be make the call 1 hour, 1 hour delay at night, and then you can wake up in the morning. If there's no snow on the ground, everybody goes in an hour late. If not, if it's a huge storm, you can just take the day off.
That is a perfect compromise. So you get a little bit of notice the day before, and then the hour may be the full extent of it, and they may go the whole nine yards. Brandon, that is brilliant.
Brandon, you should run for president.
You should, or something. Anyway, school committee, for starters. Brandon, thank you for the call. That is a totally common sense solution for a problem. And by the way, this may not seem like the biggest thing in the world, but you know how we've often talked about how you form your view about what government, state government does by how long you're in line at the registry of motor vehicles? Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing that either gives people confidence in their local governments or destroys that confidence
in their
local
governments.
Well, it's
not just that. The stress, because many bosses are not very kind in these situations.
That's exactly
right. And if you are on the edge at work already and you're paycheck to paycheck and you're kind of working for a person that's not at all sympathetic in these situations and says, your kids aren't my problem kind of deal, it puts an enormous pressure on you. I mean,
but the pressure is not removed but mitigated if it turns out you know a full, whatever it is, 12 hours in advance or 15 hours that school's going to be closed tomorrow. Instead of worrying about, well, maybe they should have been open, at least you have the evening to begin your planning. That's why I think on balance, even though they make mistakes, and a lot of communities in and around Boston obviously did make a mistake, including, I would argue, Boston itself, it's a way to go. 877-301-8970. If you're sitting at home with your kids going crazy, and maybe an inch of snow on the ground, how are you feeling about the decision of your local leaders to close your city schools?
Carl from Charlton. I was going to say Chatham, where they did get a bunch of snow. Charlton did not. Did it, Carl?
No, not very much, no.
So what do you think?
I think that they should have some type of day before warning and then a delay, like we did here in town. They warned us that the schools could be closed, but then they only had a delay of about 2 hours, and then the buses got running.
And when did they announce the delay, this morning or yesterday, Carl?
Well, I believe that it was this morning.
Yeah. Well, that's a variation on the guy who just called from Worcester. His view is do the delay the afternoon before, so at least you put people on some notice, and then they make the final decision. Carl, you sound quite happy with the outcome. Thank you very much for your call.
We get an email from Ernie. And by the way, the email address is bpr@wgbh.org.
What did he say?
Ernie said his kids go to a charter school and the only snow days there in his particular school are states of emergency, which this was not. And Don
states of emergency or snow emergencies? Virtually every community had a snow emergency.
Well, he said state of emergency.
Well, I think he means snow emergency. But in any case.
Don emailed it. We were talking yesterday about bombogenesis, the new word for Armageddon or snowpalooza. Don says the snow was not a bombogenesis. The correct word for the storm. Dudogenesis.
Well, that is what it was. And again, if you're listening from the South Shore or the Cape, we know you're not feeling this way. We're not talking about you. Clearly, in those cases, that was the right decision.
Yeah.
But we're looking out the window right here on Market Street. How much snow is on the ground?
I would say maybe 2 inches.
I would say maybe a half an inch is more. And it's aggravating to people who had to stay home. I mean, that's the part I understand. People who are staying home or having a problem vis-a-vis work. And by the way, a ton of people don't get paid if they don't go to work. It's not just an inconvenience and you got to do more work the next day. It really does create a problem.
You know, John has a point. He said because you get the advance notice when his college canceled work for the day, it allowed him to stay up all night, binge watching the last 6 episodes of Breaking Bad. Hmm. So you could plan your evening activities knowing you wouldn't have to get up so early in the morning, Jim. That is one advantage
because
of your side.
I'm finishing up The Good Wife, and the anxiety this has created in me is almost, I can't make it to work in the morning. It's so ethically troubling. Let's take one or two more quick ones. Barbara, you're in Scituate. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi.
I have about 7 to 10 inches here.
Yeah.
I think Do you suppose in the decisions to cancel school in your area,
mm-hmm.
perhaps the highway department has a stronger input than you might imagine?
Oh, no. Actually, I researched it this morning. In Cambridge, they consult a tarot card reader. And she ultimately made. Now, I assume they consult. I mean, these are pretty dramatic decisions. And as we know, people have lost public office because of bad decisions in snowstorms. That's why they take it so seriously now. I'm sure they consult everybody from the transportation people to the bus people. Can you get? I mean, in all seriousness and fairness to Boston, for example, Barbara, what you'll hear, and I bet you Marty Walsh will tell us this a week from Friday, is you can't maneuver a lot of the side streets where the buses go because they don't plow them as well, and or it's harder to plow them because they're narrower. So it's not quite as black and white as we're painting it. But my assumption is any sane elected official is consulting every major player.
Well, it's pretty hard on the sanity all around, don't you think?
I think it is, as evidenced by these calls. Barbara, thank you very much for your calls.
One last quick one, Gene, from Jefferson. I'm embarrassed to say, Gene, I'm not sure where Jefferson is. Where is it?
North of Holden. It's
okay.
A suburb of Holden, which is north of Worcester.
How's the snow situation there? Not much, right?
No, not much. But I'm calling because I grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts in the 1940s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
13 years that I went to public school, we only had 2 snow days total. And they happened to be back-to-back in 1956, so let me tell you, that was quite a storm.
I bet it was.
Yeah, we were a hardier crew back then, I
guess.
So
your view is we shouldn't even it's really got to be tough. My kids who graduated from high school, I don't know how many years ago, 5, 6 years ago, three, four years ago, there were a couple of years there where Cambridge was the last holdout, where we closed almost not at all, and as a result, they got out earlier than most kids got out. So is that what you think we should return to, toughen it out, Gene?
No, not at all, because back in that day, and I didn't go uphill both ways, it was all flat ground, but we all walked to school. There were neighborhood schools. There were no school buses, if you can imagine that. No yellow buses in Springfield in those days.
Yeah.
Now that it's almost completely opposite, where everybody is bused, I just imagine this is a thing for safety. If we had a major accident, just one bus. The pain, the suffering, the death, and the liability, who would be talking then if the schools were open?
Gene, you made it. Thanks for the call. You made a very important point, as I hinted to Barbara. I think that's a major part of the consideration, whether it's liability, safety. I guess they're all different sides of the same coin. But it is what it is. And I assume everything, except maybe, I don't even know if South Shore and Cape are reopening tomorrow. Do you know yet what the declarations have been?
I'm surprised you didn't find that out, Jim.
But I think it's fairly safe to say in Greater Boston, schools will be open tomorrow.
I think so. Okay, when we come back, we're going to look at how we can keep our gray matter from going gray. The benefits of brain training next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, and this is your brain on advertising.
We have all dreamed about being more intelligent. We need not dream anymore.
I did it to be quicker.
Just to stay sharp.
To remember people's names.
I trained to make my family proud of me, and me proud of me.
Straightforward process that helped me to really learn how to focus.
It's like a personal trainer for your brain.
If you follow the program but get no results, the program is free.
Guaranteed.
I trained to feel more sure of my driving. Now my daughter even gets in the car with me.
Personal trainer for your brain. I love that. Brain boosting is a cottage industry, but some of these exercises actually deliver and help keep your gray matter from going gray. There's a new study that finds that older adults who use brain training drills retain benefits for up to 10 years. Joining us to go over the study and its implication is the study's co-author, Sharon Tenstedt, is vice president of New England Research Institute. Sharon, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Sharon, so you buy this, that if we do these exercises, our brains will be crisper for longer. You think that's true, right?
I do think that's
true. So when should we start and what should we do?
Well, you need to start sooner than you think.
Okay.
If you look at all the studies that have been done on cognitive aging, and aging starts as soon as we're born.
That's depressing, isn't it?
Isn't it? you'll see that you really probably reach your peak in your early 20s. And then after that, you start to decline. So you know, the kind of declines that we're talking about here in relation to all this, these brain training programs or brain games, as they're often called, are really geared for people who are older. But we also find that they're starting to be used for children with disorders like ADHD, for example. So it points out that there's benefit starting younger. We don't know how young.
Uh-huh.
Our study started with people who were 65 and older. So we can't say that the training programs that we used really apply to children. But some of the other programs that are commercially available now have been used with children with specific disorders. They've also been used with women who, after receiving chemotherapy for brain cancer, and have what we call chemo brain.
Yes,
I read
that.
There's some promising evidence that some of these programs might be helpful with that.
I didn't even know that chemotherapy could affect your brain until I read this material this morning.
Okay, we'll get the benefits we're already celebrating, but let's step back for a second and talk about when we will talk about what it benefits and what it may not benefit. What is brain training? I mean, how is it done? When I first read about these kinds of things prior to your study, I do crossword puzzles. And I said to Margaret, I do crossword puzzles. This is great news. But then I read, well, that may not be the deal. What is brain training according to you?
Okay. We started, you need to understand that we started this this program back in 1996. So, you know, much earlier than today and much more before all these commercially available programs were out there and being, you know, pushed. And we knew from small laboratory studies that if you trained on a specific ability like memory or executive reasoning or speed of processing, that you could actually improve that cognitive ability. What we didn't know and what this study then did was
how long it would last.
And if it would then transfer to being able to handle complex activities of daily living. So, you know, I'm talking about things like managing your finances and taking your medications and, you know, driving. Driving is a very complex cognitive task, even though, you know, you also need physical abilities.
Right.
You've got to have good cognition to be able to drain and to drive and avoid accidents, et cetera.
But what is the actual training? I mean,
so what we did was we developed training that was targeted at three specific cognitive abilities: memory, executive reasoning, and speed of processing.
Excuse me. What is executive reasoning, please?
Problem solving.
Oh, okay.
Problem solving. It's like, how do you take the information, the knowledge that you have, and apply it to novel situations and be able to figure out a way to deal with a complex situation?
Okay.
Okay. That's what executive reasoning is. Speed of processing, how quickly you react to stimuli and be able to, you know, develop an appropriate response.
Okay.
So pick one and tell us what the training is for that particular thing.
Okay. Well, the speed of processing training is the most interesting one. It had the biggest effect, so let me tell you about that
Sure.
one. It was actually delivered on a computer, and if you go on to some of the commercially available ones, you'll programs now, you'll see, because they're very similar.
It's like Lumosity and Posit Science, which we'll get to in a while, but that's what you're
right.
talking
that's
about,
That's what
right?
I'm talking about. What they do in those programs right now, which are, you know, you do online, so they're computer-based, is they will show you stimuli. So they might show you, for example, something in the middle of the circle and then ask you to identify, you know, what it is. And then also there's something on the periphery of the circle, and you're supposed to point, to click to where it is on the periphery. So you got to – it's really divided attention. You have to figure out what's in the middle and where that thing is, whatever it is, a bird or, you know, an X or whatever, on the periphery. You know, so think of it as a clock. Is
right.
it at 2 o'clock? Is it at 4 o'clock? And then how fast you do it.
Huh.
Okay, so it's how quickly you attend to things – and how accurate you are. And as you get good at it, it presents those stimuli faster, and it throws in even more distractors on the screen. So instead of looking, you're looking for two objects, but perhaps it's got four up there now or six up there, and you have to find the one that, you know, that you're supposed to be finding, indicate where it is, and try to ignore all that other stuff. So think about that in relation to driving, right? You're driving down the street and you've got all these things
vision.
That you're looking at. And do you see that red light? Do you know what red means? Do you know that that's supposed to, you know, you're supposed to stop when you see a red light?
Why are you looking at me like, Sharon's looking at me like, do you know, Jim, you're supposed to stop when you see a red light? My cognitive whatevers are still pretty good, Sharon, let me tell you.
I don't know about your peripheral vision, Jim. You could be 2 feet to your left.
So to do this, both in your testing and, again, I assume comparable things in the commercial programs, how often do you have to do this for it to work? How often and for how long?
Okay, what we did, and this is the remarkable thing, is we had structured training sessions. They lasted about an hour. We did them twice a week with small groups of older adults. And we did them for 10 sessions. Okay?
That's a lot.
It is a lot.
Yeah.
But then they stopped. And 10 years later, they're still pretty good.
And why does this last for 10 years? I understand I know you did. You said 95, whenever it was, it made total sense right away to believe that if you do some training, there are going to be immediate impacts and positive consequences. Right. Why would the benefit last if you stop the training for 10 years? If you exercise, I assume if you do physical exercise, you're in great shape right away. 10 years later, you're still not fit. Mm-hmm. So why does the brain operate differently?
Well, that's what we don't know right now.
Oh.
Okay. I mean, this is the first study that has shown that these cognitive training or these brain exercises, if you will, if you do them in a structured manner, will last this long. We don't know why. We don't know what it does to the brain itself. You know, it's doing something up there. Just as we know physical exercise affects your brain, you know, the whole endorphins or we also know now that it releases other hormones that actually, you know, help stimulate the neurons in your brain. We're not sure how it works.
But it works.
But it's doing something to the brain that's lasting, we think.
We're talking with Sharon Tenstedt. I got it right there. Vice President of New England Research Institutes about this whole study about training your brain and the long-lasting effects it can have. So I went on Lumosity and Posit this morning, and you know right away they hook you in because it says, do you want to remember where you put everything, like your car keys or your glasses? Do you want to remember everybody's name after one introduction? Of course. So you're checking off all these things you'd like to be able to do. Then I realize it costs $15 a month, and I think Posit is about the same. Maybe it's $14 a month. And I never really got to what they're going to have me training because I didn't want to sign up because that seemed a lot of money. So if you don't want to do that, and can you do the jumbles or Sudoku or the crossword puzzles, or what can you do if you want to do this, and how much a day do you think you can need to do it?
Well, I don't know if I could address how much a day you need to do it. You need to do something regularly.
Yep.
And so what we know is, you know, there is what's called a dose response effect. The more you do it, the better you're going to be. All right. And one of the issues that I have with the commercially available programs, as well as doing something like crossword puzzles or Sudoku, is the more you do it, the better you get at doing that.
Right.
Okay. We call it training to the test. We don't know if that then transfers or translates to some other important daily living activity that you need to maintain. Our study showed that it did. But we don't know if doing some of these other things will do the same thing. However, we know it's good for your brain, you know, to do it. If you don't do it, you are going to lose brain matter.
Sharon, you talked about three categories. This problem solving, I know you don't call it that, but the more lay language for us, the speed of reasoning and memory. Yeah. My recollection from having read the piece, the stories about this, is the area in which it was least effective long-term was memory. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is there any positive impact on memory or the
impact was.
Long
there
term
was.
Even?
Up to 5 years.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And so is the theory then if you did the training again after five years, then maybe it'd go another 5 years, then
possibly.
Another five
yes,
years?
Possibly.
So does this, I understand in terms of cognitive function, this is pretty, I mean, considering baby boomers are what, 50% of the population or whatever they are, the potential impact of this is colossal.
Huge.
But beyond just being able to think more clearly and react more immediately, things like dementia, Alzheimer's, is there any evidence at all that this has any impact on either of those?
Not yet.
Okay.
Okay, we can't say that yet. And we can't say from our study that it would have an effect on delaying dementia or have any effect on Alzheimer's. We do know from our study that those who have mild cognitive impairment can get better. I mean, they were trainable. But we don't really know that.
Okay, so if we don't want to do the online things for $15 a month, what should we do? If you're going to set aside 15 minutes a day or half an hour every two, whatever, what should we do?
Anything that challenges your brain.
Okay, but okay. I would argue that, you know, I write for a living. I'm on the radio now, but in my other job, I write for a living, which is
that
challenges
good.
My brain.
That's good.
But, and I often, yeah.
You she just wants to save $15 a month, Sharon. That's well, where this
but I'm wondering, okay, that's one good thing, write things. But what else?
Anything, that, if you can put yourself in a complex situation which requires, and someone, something that's new uh-huh. for you. In yeah. other words.
Should you memorize poems?
If that's a new activity for you, yes.
Okay.
Okay. And then see if you can remember them or to read something and then several hours later try to reconstruct the main points of that short story, for example. But you have to challenge yourself in an area that's new. Don't keep doing the same thing that you're good at, which is what we all like to do because it makes us feel better, right?
Okay.
That we're good at something. But you have to try different things.
So okay, how about if you did like the jumbles on Monday and you did the crossword puzzle on Wednesday and you did, you know, the reading the short story on Friday?
It's probably going to help you, yes, for
okay.
sure.
Jumbles
for
are
sure.
for like 7-year-olds, Marjorie.
I don't know. I had a difficult time this morning.
Oh, but
it took
me
a long time.
When you get
time.
To the bottom one, it's really
yeah,
tough.
I so, couldn't figure them all out.
The most novel and challenging.
You know,
right?
the most yes. interesting, well, there are many interesting parts of your conclusions in your research, Sharon Tentz, that what is most amazing to me is that you not seem to be saying, you are saying that training over a short period of time with great intensity has tremendous results down the line. One of the reasons so many of us don't do what we all know we should do is go to the gym is because you go to the gym, you got to go to the gym, and you got to keep going to the gym constantly or else you gain back the weight, you're aerobic, whatever. Most of the benefits disappear. What you're saying here, and this is a question, not a statement, is if you dedicate yourself to this, and you can come up with the $15 a month for the commercial thing. I assume you don't have to sign up for life, whatever. Well, that's you're shaking your hand, so maybe you can answer that too. But if you can figure out a program that works for you, that's affordable, that is for a finite period of time but is intense, that may be all you have to do for a period. Is that what you're saying or is it not?
I'm saying it's going to help you. All right.
But ongoing
it, it's
is better?
Not yes, because okay. it's not going to reverse the normal decline in cognitive function that goes along with aging. So if you look at the results of our study, what you will find is that even the people who were trained declined over time in terms of their cognitive abilities. They just didn't decline as fast or as much as our control group who wasn't trained at all.
So if you want to continue to slow that decline even further, you'd continue the
you
training.
Could.
Now, did the
we can't say that from our study, but it makes sense that if you got more of it over a period of time, that it would slow that decline down more.
Can we talk about the commercial thing for one more second?
Sure.
Lumosity and the posit science.
Art says you can get part, you can get some of it for free if you don't
can.
Want it customized to you, so you don't necessarily have to pay.
But the way they're constructed, the way that's an emailer, by the way.
It's an emailer.
The way
Sorry.
This is constructed, do they do it in such a way, these commercial firms, so that essentially, for I don't even know how to express this, they make it such that if you don't continue with the program, someone says, well, I really can't afford $180 a year on something that may be iffy for me. Can you do a limited, let's say, 3 months of this or a certain number of months and expect there to be some benefit without making this a lifelong behavior?
I would say there's potential for that. But let me just throw out a few cautionary comments about these commercially available programs. I think they ought to offer a lot of promise. And Posit Science, the programs that they offer actually were based on our speed of processing
oh, really?
Training program, yes. And they have done some research of their own. So they actually have worked with the investigator who developed mm-hmm. that program and made it, put it online and made it available. So you know, that's the one I probably the most comfortable saying should have reasonably similar type effects.
Is there any financial connection between the New England Research
no.
Institutes and them? Okay,
no.
go ahead.
No, there isn't.
Okay.
Okay. In terms of Lumosity is really quite similar. If you look at the two programs side by side, they're very similar in terms of how they're structured. Lumosity is newer, and it also was designed by scientists from Stanford as well as other external experts, some of whom I know. This is why I think that it's not just something that, you know, somebody who knows how to program games mm-hmm. developed. They have done less research to date on their program, but I think it offers promise. What they have, a lot of their research, what they do is they track the scores of people when they start, and then after a certain amount of time, they look at the improvement. Well, that just says you're getting better at doing that. It's not necessarily saying...
Understood.
Okay. So, but I think they'll get there. I think it offers promise. We just don't know yet. Okay.
Sharon, two final things for me. Did you, in 95, were you with the New England Research?
Yes.
Did you do the training?
Actually take the training?
Yeah.
I did when we were training the trainers, the people who were actually going to deliver it.
So what impact has it had on you?
I didn't do it long enough.
Okay. And second question, you started this by saying, while most of the focus has been on baby boomers, essentially, which is a huge market, there's potential large benefit for younger people. Is the training, I assume, different for younger people than it would be for somebody who's 55 or 65 or 75?
You mean the commercially available programs?
Yeah.
Well, the nice thing about them is that they actually gear it towards... in relation to your performance.
To you. Okay.
So you would expect, for example, a younger adult to be faster and more accurate than someone who is 70 years old.
So they do a baseline thing when
they
you go.
They do a baseline thing. And then depending on your responses, they change the speed. So if you're already fast, you know, they'll up it even more.
So that's the advantage, I guess, of getting a one that's just focused on you. I just want to ask you in general. I mean, you know, I went to an event earlier this fall and someone that was there was 91 years old and spoke for an hour with no notes. So obviously there's a great
range.
Exactly. But in general, I mean, when does this big slide start when you're – I know that we're getting older from the moment and we peak in our 20s. But big time cognitive stuff
you
generally.
You probably start to notice it in your 50s.
Okay.
And then it kind of becomes more and more apparent. And I think, when my parents were young, they were probably experiencing it, you know, in their 60s.
Yeah.
I would like to think for someone at my age, I'm not going to experience it until later in life. But, you know, late 70s, early 80s, you're probably really experiencing it.
You know, Sharon, I told you I was done after that, but I just thought of something else. Marjorie and I have been involved in a campaign for ages since we've been on the radio together. To make Massachusetts in line with the vast majority of other states that require some level of cognitive testing for older drivers. And we were AARP, put out bulletins attacking us, how dare you do this, all this sort of stuff. Has your organization done any work with states or registries of motor vehicles, departments of motor vehicles around the country? It seems to me this is exactly the kind of thing that could be used to ensure that we don't read another story of someone saying, I thought the gas pedal was the brake, I thought the brake was the gas pedal, I didn't see the red light. Has any of that happened?
One of the outcomes that we looked at for the speed of processing training was auto crashes based on state driving records. And we know at 5 years, and we're currently looking at the 10-year data, that people who took the speed of processing training had fewer crashes than those who weren't trained. And that work really came out of and was conducted, that analysis was conducted by Dr. Carlene Ball at the University of Birmingham, Alabama at Birmingham, and she's the one who designed the speed of processing training. So it has an effect. And she has worked closely with the Department of Transportation as well as, you know, many of the state departments.
Great.
Okay.
And registries to develop these programs. So there is benefit there for that.
One last thing, Sharon, before you go. There was one of the stories we were reading this morning in preparation for your arrival here that says the brains of elderly people slow because they know so much. It's not necessarily cognitive decline. Do you buy that? Or
no.
That's just okay. That takes care of that. Thank you so much.
Great to meet you.
For
this is great. Thank you.
Sharon Tenstead is the Vice President of New England Research Institutes, and she has told us wonderful things about getting our brains exercised. We better all start immediately. She is the study's co-author of this great piece of research. Up next, Brian McGroy, editor of the Boston Globe, is going to join us. He's going to talk about bombogenesis and some really disturbing new information out of the Archdiocese in Chicago about priest abuse.
Sounds great. Thanks. We'll be right back. You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, and we are joined, as we are every Wednesday, by the editor of the Boston Globe. He is Brian McGrory. Hey, Brian.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Great.
Good morning, Brian McGrory.
Good morning, Marjorie Egan. How are you?
Good. So have you survived bombogenesis, or are you calling in from a snowbank somewhere, stranded in the suburbs, Brian?
Well, there are no snowbanks after this storm. That's the thing. I mean, should this serve as our final warning to stop heeding all these warnings about snow? I mean, come on. This is ridiculous what happened today. It really is. It's embarrassing.
We didn't know we were going to get you started. Go ahead.
It is embarrassing. Yeah.
What's embarrassing?
What's embarrassing is, you know, what is it? A third of the flights at Logan Airport canceled, schools canceled all across the state for what? 2 inches of snow?
Ridiculous.
Come on.
Ridiculous.
Jim, come on.
I am totally with you, but you glossed over Marjorie's term. I am betting you don't even know what bombogenesis is. Is that a safe assumption, editor of the Boston Globe?
I have no idea. I was figuring if I ignored it, you would just let me slide, but obviously, Jim, that's not your way, is it?
So in a moment of seriousness here, it is far better. I think we'd all agree politically, even though we didn't intend to discuss this with you, it would be far worse to keep schools open and then have a snowpocalypse. Or whatever they call those things. But the flip side is, this was Marty Walsh's first snow decision. He said it quite strongly in his office yesterday. He's got 450 trucks out, or whatever it is, closing the schools. Does that come back in a small way to haunt the new mayor?
I don't think it does, but dial back for a second to the school cancellations, if you would. Why are we canceling school a day ahead of time? Why aren't we doing what we used to do back when you and I were kids, and that is, you wake up in the morning and you figure out whether there's school that day. And if superintendents had done that today, most kids would be in school.
This is what we talked about earlier. This is what you should be doing. 6 o'clock in the morning, find out whether or not you have to go to school, because we do look ridiculous. I mean, Cambridge is closed, Brookline is closed, Boston is closed, and there's no snow. And it's such a pain in the neck for all the parents who have to scramble like mad lunatics to figure out what they're going to do. They're going to drive the kids to school? Are they going to have to pay $1 million for parents in a pinch? I mean, what do they do with the kids on snow days? It's such a hassle.
It's ridiculous. You remember a couple of years ago, at that point, I thought that was the worst example of overreaction to snow. But out in Somerville, they ticketed and towed several hundred cars on a predicted snowstorm, and it didn't snow a flake. And all these people had their cars towed, and it never actually snowed.
You know, Brian, I asked you a couple of weeks ago when Menino was leaving, weren't you dying to write a column? And you said you were dying. This could be a 5-part series had you still been on the Metro section, right?
I mean, I got to tell you, I'm not telling you anything I don't say inside over here. I hate weather stories, hate them with a passion, just hate them. The problem is readers love them, and I love readers. So we give weather stories, but I do it with my teeth gritted, and look, I understand that weather can be dangerous. I understand that it's a tough thing to mock, but what happened today is absurd.
It's ridiculous. And by the way, just so you're au courant, bombogenesis is the 2014 version of Snowmageddon and Snowpocalypse, all those terms we had before. That's the new term, because we couldn't, the polar vortex, we already used that, so we had to move on to something else, and it's bombogenesis.
So is this a Jim and Marjorie invention? Or
No.
Who invented it, Jim?
I'd be doing a little Googling if I were you as soon as we hang up.
I think
Brian
some
McGrory.
Meteorologist invented it somewhere along the line. So Brian McGrory...
No, but actually his favorite meteorologist, and I know this
Matt
to be
Noyes.
The case because Brian wrote about him a couple of years ago, Matt Noyes came on with us yesterday and ridiculed the use of the term, saying it was a creation of other meteorologists whose sole goal was to, I think I used the word, to titillate the viewers, the listeners, the readers, that sort of thing. So you're on the same page.
I love Matt Noyes.
Yeah,
He's great. So we had, we're speaking with Brian McGrory from the Boston Globe. We had Shira Springer, also from the Globe, on yesterday talking about going off to the Olympics at Sochi. And obviously, you know, Brian, that warships are going to be in the ready with helicopters and, teams to get people out of there looking for these black widows. How nerve-wracking is this for you as the boss? What do you do about your three reporters going over there?
Look, it's not a great feeling knowing we're sending several reporters, producers, videographers over to an area where, no question about it, it's going to be tense. And I'm not going to say we're as far as look at, nobody's frightened or anything like that. We're relying on the security. Putin has talked about, what, 40,000 security officers over there? So we take heart in that. But these games feel different than anything that's come before. And, you know, we're a little bit on edge about this one.
And so do you say to a reporter, I'm serious about this, before they go into an area like this, are they assigned, or is there a discussion where people say, if you're uncomfortable in this deal, and I assume there are other dangerous situations, I know there are, where your reporters end up doing work, are they given the option not to do this? Not that any of them would.
Yeah, they absolutely are. Okay. Look, we had David Filipov over in the outskirts of Russia when he was researching the Sarnaev family,
right.
And he was under, and David Filipov is experienced and good a reporter in these environments as you can get, and you know, he was under orders, don't do anything foolish, don't take undue risks for the sake of a story. You know, David is a different kind of breed, and he got great information from there. But we will sit down with the reporters going over to the Olympics and have that same discussion.
Well, Brian McGroy, I would assume that's also true with wars. I mean, there are some people who are big chickens. I might be one of them that wasn't anxious to go to any war zone. I mean, they're volunteers that want to go over to cover the first Iraq war, the second Iraq war, Afghanistan, all that. Volunteers, correct?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
And it's actually... much to the credit of people in this business, it's a coveted assignment. People put their hand up; they want to go to these places, and you know, it's a really admirable trait. But that doesn't mean that those who don't want to go that there's anything wrong with them.
At all. Good.
Hey, Brian, I am, of the three of us, I am the only non-Catholic, but I am obsessed with the Catholic Church since the sexual abuse thing reared its head in your place, in your paper, and others, you know, a decade or so ago. You hire John Allen from the National Catholic Reporter. We read a couple of days ago that in the wake of this United States UN Commission on the Rights of Children hearing with the Vatican about how they violated many of the mandates, I guess, for lack of a better expression, of this group, that the Vatican leaks that they defrocked 400 priests in 2011, 2012 under Pope Benedict. And then we read yesterday that Chicago is disgorging, the archdiocese there is disgorging all these documents which talk about abuse within the archdiocese, shifting priests from parish to parish, believing they could fix them and not disclosing the public, sort of a mini, if you can use that term, or at least a variation of what happened in Boston. And some of it involves the cardinal, Cardinal George, who is still there, and his personal involvement, at least, I guess, in three of these cases. We've all been raving about the first year of Pope Francis. Have we been glossing over what I would argue is his underperformance on what, at least in a Pew Center poll, was the single most important issue for him to confront amongst Catholics?
It's an excellent question, Jim. And look, I'm not going to miss this opportunity to dial back a little further than you did on the Catholic Church issues. The public attention truly began back in 2002, 2003, when the Boston Globe started shedding all this light on what was going on here in Boston in terms of the cardinal sending pedophilic priests from one parish to another without warning parents. And many, many of these priests molested kids anew, even though it was quite apparent that they were they would do this again. So it began here, and in terms of shedding light on it, and now we're seeing you know, all of these revelations in Chicago. Many of them had come out before in dribs and drabs. What we're seeing now is a complete kind of, as you called it, what do you call it, a disgorging of documents.
Yeah.
It's really troubling what's going on with the cardinal there. Now, I'm equally troubled by his revelations about his predecessor, Cardinal Bernardine,
mm-hmm.
Who was beloved in the Catholic Church. Do you remember he was the one who was accused by a teenager of molestation?
Yep.
He eventually recanted. That cardinal was considered a true moderate and real intellectual, and these documents show that he had done some things for pedophilic priests that he absolutely should not have done. So that's very troubling. In terms of the question on the Pope, I don't know. Shouldn't we give him a little bit more time? He's been in a year. He's been a year, what is it, next month?
Yeah, I think so.
He's been dealing with issues in the Vatican. He's been setting a new tone. Certainly, he hasn't done on the issue of abuse of priests what a lot of people would hope he would do or will do. But my sense is that let's not be too impatient here.
Yeah, you know, well, you know the people over at bishopsaccountability.org, Brian, they're great, Ann Barrett Doyle and Terry McKiernan, that do all this documenting of this church scandal. Their big point, and I think it's a great one, is that he hasn't even made the symbolic gestures that he might have. You know, he's it will be, what, March when he's there for a year? When was
he? I think
so.
Or,
and it's now January.
What does it mean, meeting with survivors,
yeah,
that sort of thing?
Or? Yeah, or entertaining some of the survivor groups or something. I'm kind of surprised by it myself. He has this commission. He's got this group together, you know, led by Sean O'Malley, and they're going to, well, not led by Sean O'Malley, but he's one of the people
them, yeah,
there. And they're going to look into this too. But I've been disappointed that he hasn't. It's a huge black hole, and that he hasn't really addressed it more forcefully.
Well, what am I missing, Marjorie? Isn't this commission a fairly big deal?
Well, you know, it was interesting. Right after he became the Pope, look at the things he did. He went out and he washed the feet of the kids that were the prisoners, you know, a couple of young women, teenage girls, a couple of Muslims and stuff like that. Those or meeting with people just impromptu.
With huge symbolism.
Yes. Homeless people, etc. Where are the survivors in that group? I mean, I just think that they should have gotten more priority in his own, even just a symbolic gesture, having somebody over to the vet or going to meet them somewhere. You know what I'm saying? There's thousands of these people all around the world, and I think he should have done a little bit. I'm hoping he still will, but for my money, he should have done something already, and I'm rather disappointed he hasn't.
I mean, I get the disappointment. I'm not in the business of advocating for a pope, but, you know, I know a year, or at this point 10 months, is still a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm you know, still taking a wait-and-see attitude here, and if we're still having this discussion in another 6 months or so, then maybe that tone changes, but... you know, let's give it a little bit of time.
Okay, so we're going to change gears completely here, if we can, Brian. And many of our listeners say, why don't you ask Brian more about his personal life? So here it is. What are you doing? I know you like that. What are you doing Friday night, Brian?
Jim, you always scare me when you First of all, you get a special tone when you start asking.
Okay, well, fine. Then you don't have to answer. We assume,
I think the word, Marjorie, is unctuous, but...
Well, maybe it is.
That's a very good word.
Okay, so Marjorie and I were betting that this is what you'll be watching Friday night.
You just get beat up constantly. Oh, Mitt Romney's a flip-flop, or he's this, he's that. I go, man, is this worth it?
And it's like trying to convince people that Dan Quayle is smart, all right? You're not going to convince them that Dan Quayle is smart. And it may be, I got to live with that. Oh, you're flipping everything. In which case... I think I'm a flawed candidate.
Now, how much are you dying sincerely to see Mitt the movie, which is available, a documentary, 6 years somebody followed in the most intimate situations, is available on Netflix on Friday. Are you not dying to see this thing?
I mean, I'll be honest. I am dying to see it.
Yeah. So are we.
Me too.
I mean, I truly am. You've seen the trailer.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's from the trailer, what we just played a couple minutes
trailer,
ago.
The trailer is fantastic. I mean, it really is well put together. And you read the Matt Visor story in the Globe, which he kind of raved about it. I'm very, very excited about seeing this.
Did you see, we've mentioned this a couple times since, Maureen Dowd writes, and you can't tell if it's tongue-in-cheek or not, Maureen Dowd writes a piece in the Sunday paper, and Mitt went and saw it at the Sundance Festival. It's available to all of us, as I said, on Netflix on Friday, and said, you know, some people who are now worried that the moderate, for lack of a better expression, Republican candidate for the nomination in 2016 may be, well, he's tainted at least and may be gone, Chris Christie, that some money people within the Republican Party ranks are actually talking about Mitt Romney. Can something like this, which apparently humanizes him to the extreme, is there even a remote chance in your head that there could be a third coming of Mitt Romney as presidential candidate out of this?
I mean, boy, it's a great question, and you know that the most important rule about politics is everything is relative.
Yeah.
And if there's nobody else, and Chris Christie was considered the best figure to pick up the mantle of any sort of moderation, Might there be Romney? I don't know. I mean, he's still vigorous. Do you think any part of the country is looking at Romney and saying, or looking at Obama and saying, well, maybe we would have done better with Romney?
I think lots of people agree.
He's handled himself well in defeat. He's actually been much more gracious in defeat than he ever was as a candidate. And Jim, I'm assuming you've had him on your TV show. And the reality is, when you're with Mitt Romney in person, when you're around the guy and you're talking with him, he's an uncommonly thoughtful politician. And that really didn't come across much during that campaign.
Well, you know, it's in light of your comment, and you do know because I know you're a big fan of Broadside. I don't know if it's called Broadside then. When he was governor, I'd occasionally have him on for the whole half hour.
We had him on the radio.
And, yep. And it is totally true what you're saying, Brian, is that particularly during breaks, but even in casual conversation on the air, he came across as a different person. But you say to yourself, you know the whole line when the great concession that Al Gore did when he conceded the second time to George W. Bush
and said,
this time I'm not going to call him back. And everybody said, God, if Al Gore had that sense of humor when he was actually running, he'd be president of the United States. You say to yourself, though, but if someone is smart and skillful as an Al Gore or a Mitt Romney has no ability with all these high paid advisors to show the public who they really are,
Excuse me. You're giving me a totally different spin than you usually did about what you thought about Mitt Romney when you interviewed him in person. Yeah, we always had the same impression. I don't know if you did, Brian, but very, very smart guy, obviously very thoughtful guy, as Brian just said, but like an adolescent sense of humor.
So?
Telling you these jokes that were like something you'd hear from somebody.
Yeah, no, I have said, but that's not
14.
Inconsistent.
Well,
but
it's odd. It was odd.
Yeah, I'm not so sure it was an adolescent sense of humor or the sense of humor of a campy uncle. You know,
I think that
maybe,
may be true.
Maybe.
But I guess my question is, if you want to be the leader of the free world, again, and you're Gore or Romney or whoever, and you can't convey who you and those close to you believe is the real you, that's a pretty big deal, isn't it? You need a documentarian to show that you're an actual normal people who has normal emotions. You know what
but
I'm
that's
saying?
That's unbelievably common in the business of politics.
It is,
We saw it in the last gubernatorial race when Charlie Baker twisted and turned and, you know, made into a pretzel by a bunch of political consultants who had absolutely no idea how to win a race. And for whatever reason, these candidates, politicians, listen to the people advising them. I don't know if it's because they're paying them a lot of money, because they know they've been doing this for a long time, that they're battle-tested in campaigns, but that's just what happens.
Well, you know, on that note, and one more thing on this, I don't mean to belabor this. I'm so glad you said what you said. I think the most egregious example of that from a guy who I assume regrets it, Bob Schrum, a Democratic political consultant, I think is 0-7 in presidential campaigns. I am a huge believer that when John Kerry, who came to fame because of those comments he made before the Foreign Relations Committee, 50 plus years ago, said that he supported the Iraq War, you say to yourself, the only reason he said that is because Bob Schrum, I don't know this, said to him, if you don't support the Iraq war, you're not going to be president of the United States. And then he loses the presidency in part because he did support the war. And you got to say to yourself, be true to yourself. I hate to be as trite as that comes out. All these guys have regrets after the fact that they weren't who they say they really are. It's pathetic.
I agree. I think the Kerry defeat was a little more complicated than
I agree.
Much of it had to do with their failure to react in the
that's true.
In the summer of that campaign, when they were all these revelations came up about the Swift boat situation.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. We forgot about the Swift boat situation.
One
which
last
was
thing,
devastating
Brian.
We want to ask you about this because Jim is I don't know if you've seen him physically lately, but he's working out now.
Yeah.
He's in shape. He's
I'm
lost
in shape.
A lot of weight. He's looking terrific.
I look terrific.
And he now is a proponent of standing desks.
Mm-hmm.
Big piece in the
excuse me, Brian. Excuse
yeah.
me.
Yeah, you know, or you know the things those little balls you sit on. You know those great big inflatable balls you sit and you roll around in front of your desk.
Tell him why I'm for standing desks.
Well, was it just another big piece confirming what we've known for some time? I think it was in the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Showing how detrimental it is to sit down, how it's bad for your spine, it's bad for your internal organs, it's bad for everything. So, Brian, Jim wants to be sure that you at the Boston Globe are leading the way in the standing desk front, that the newsroom is now full of these standing desks.
You don't make your reporters sit, I hope, do you?
I would sit down in the shower if I could. Although I walk around the room and it is so disconcerting because basically half the newsroom is standing, half is sitting, half of them are in this in-between position where they have like a bar stool. I like a world that likes to sit. You know,
I like a world that likes to sit. That's his epitaph of Brian McCrory. Okay, Brian. Now, Brian, you're going to give us you'll give us a film review next Wednesday on MIT, right?
So I'm going to sound like an idiot. Do I need a subscription to Netflix?
This
to
is
get
pathetic.
It
to...
Yes, you do.
$7.99. Can you afford $7.99 a month?
Why don't you invite me over, Jim?
I don't think so.
And if you've got one of those new enough TVs, you can not only watch it on a computer, you can plug it into your television.
Wow, Marjorie.
But I think you have to have a newer TV than my version. I don't know how new they have to be. Do you know that, Jim?
Brian, if you're a little short on dough, too, you subscribe and then you cancel your subscription after you so admit. You know what I mean?
So do I point my rabbit ears in a specific direction to get Netflix?
Yes, you do. That'll work fine for you. Brian McGrory, it's a pleasure. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks, Brian. Brian McGrory is the editor of the Boston Globe, and we talk to him every Wednesday. And when we come back, medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us to talk about the ethics of scrubbing our memory of bad memories and what happens when doctors go gumshoe and Google their patients. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When it comes to our medical care, who doesn't want their physician to do everything he or she can to give us the right diagnosis? But what if our doctor's search for the cause of our ailments includes Googling us? And what if that Google search leads our doctor to finding out things we haven't come clean about, like, I don't know, how much we drink, the cigarette we have on occasion, or that mugshot when you're arrested on drug charges? And by the way, that mugshot incident really happened, and it could happen to you. Joining us on the line to talk about where doctors should draw the line when it comes to getting to know you and what we should be telling our doctors is Art Kaplan. As you know, Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art, great to talk to you again.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
We're great, Art Kaplan. Thank you, as always, for joining us. So there's this great piece a few days back in the New York Times by a Beth Israel doctor saying that most other physicians he knows do Google their patients. You're the ethicist here. What do you think of this, Art Kaplan?
I'm surprised they have any time to do it. But if they do, I suspect that you put that information up there, and people are going to find it. Sometimes your doctor may find it. Sometimes the doctor's secretary may find it. Sometimes the lab tech may find it. But information that heads up onto the internet, I wouldn't put anything up there that I didn't want my doctor to see.
Now, well, what if you didn't? But what if you didn't put it up there? I mean, what about this extreme example I just mentioned?
Oh, you mean coming through the public records?
Right. There's a mugshot.
The elderly cokehead.
No, right. A woman comes in and they detect in the story the doctor tells the cocaine in her system, but she's older.
Yeah.
They can't imagine. It turns out they Google her, and there's a mugshot of her after a cocaine arrest. Is that she didn't put it up?
That's a hunt, so to speak, because she didn't put it up there.
Right.
So let's divide it in two. I think if you put information up there yourself, you should be ready for your boss, your doctor, your lawyer, anybody, to your ex-girlfriend, anybody to find it. It's you've got to understand that. And if you're probably under the age of about 30, you know that and you don't care. For that particular group, privacy is eroding fast. They look around and see, you know, the government monitoring every move they make and their GPS reporting where they are. And they know when it hits the internet, it's public. But for a lot of younger people, don't care. The other side, that's searching and hunting. The doctor, I think, should not be doing that, should not, certainly not without telling the patient. So for me, there's no ethical laws prohibiting it. But if I go to the doctor and the doctor's thinking, wonder if there's any criminal record on you, I think I'll run a search and just see what I can find out, I'm going to feel betrayed. I'm going to feel used, and I'm certainly not going to trust that doctor.
But Art Kaplan, there was a compelling case that this doctor references in his piece about a young woman, 26 years old, goes to a surgeon wanting a prophylactic double mastectomy. Mm. And she said there was an extensive history of cancer in her family, but she didn't want to go undergo any workup. And her team was suspicious, her medical team. And then they did search online and found out she had set up all these multiple Facebook accounts soliciting donations for cancers she never had. So
I don't know. That's a good ending. I'm not. Does it means justify the ends there?
No, I still think you tell her. You say, you know, we have suspicions about somebody who says they don't want to work up, which, by the way, is indicative of a problem right there. And if you tell us that, we're going to check around to see what we can find out about you, because people don't come in and tell us what tests to do in order to figure out whether they're at risk of breast cancer relative to getting a double mastectomy. So she's flying red flags. And there I would just be forthright. That may drive her away. She may go on to try and scam other people. But I think you got to be forthright.
You know, let's turn the tables here if we can. As you were speaking, Art, I was thinking about this. So let's divide the categories you do. Information you post with you, the patient, which the expectation is that anybody could go after it, including a doctor. You go into a doctor says to you, do you take X drug? No, I don't take anything like that. So he or she prescribes Y. You have a horrible outcome because you lied, and the combination of those drugs is a disaster, but you lied. Mm-hmm. The doctor gets sued. This hasn't happened yet, I don't think, by the patient saying, okay, it is true, I didn't fully disclose, but it is there for anybody to see on my Facebook page that I take X, and the doctor should have done what any doctor is doing in 2014 and checked me out, Googled me. Had he or she done that, they would have known that I was too embarrassed to mention that I was taking X, and as a result, he or she has committed malpractice. That's not beyond the pale to think about, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Why? Why?
It is because it isn't part of the standard of care or the expectation that there's a duty to go check you out in public places like Google. It could grow to that someday, but it's not there yet.
Well, I understand that, but let's assume that part of that, I don't mean to take it to an extreme, but let me do it. As Marjorie said, this guy who wrote, the doctor who wrote the piece for the New York Times, is it Beth Israel Deaconess? The woman is part of her case. Her lawyer puts in, well, we've checked with all the doctors at Beth Israel. 79% of them Google their patients, so it has become the standard practice at Beth Israel. That guy's in a little bit of trouble, isn't he?
Nope, still don't think so. It doesn't matter whether they're doing it. It's not part of the, if you will, how to take a history on a patient, the requirements that come out about where you look for information. There's no group, no specialty, nobody who's saying, hey, by the way, check them out on Google too. So not quite there yet. And I got to jump in here and say, I had one of these. I got a call from a big hospital on the East Coast located in Connecticut, not to be named, which has a transplant program. And a guy had come in and said, you know I have to be sober for a year before I can be listed for an organ transplant. And lo and behold, someone in the office Googled him, caught a picture of him hoisting a beer in a bar. There was a picture of him with a big mug of beer. And they said, looks to us like you're not sober. And he confessed that he wasn't. And they made him sort of put him back 6 months in terms of getting his organ, which certainly puts his life at risk. So there's one where he was caught in a lie by somebody just floating around on Google. Do I think that's sort of an expectation that they're going to check him out? No. Do I think they should tell him that they did check him out? Yes. The one thing he has a right to is rebuttal. Maybe some friend of his put that up there. Maybe he says he never drank the beer. Maybe he says it's an old picture. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah.
Google isn't necessarily definitive, right? Everything that's up there. Think about what people put up there when they're trying to find a date. I'm told that not every description is fully accurate.
Yeah. Speaking of things being fully accurate, this isn't really on topic, but it's close. I often wonder when you go into a new physician and you fill out the forms and they ask you, you know, how much do you drink and do you take recreational drugs? Mm-hmm. I've often thought to myself, would people, I mean, if somebody's snorting cocaine on the weekends, like the Wolf of Wall Street, are they going to put that in their medical form? Or even, you know, marijuana, even though ideas are changing, these are illegal drugs, or even admit how much they drink. Do you have a sense that how truthful people are?
That's a great question. I don't think they're truthful at all.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
I think you go in there and you sort of say, yeah, I drink like a fish. I visit prostitutes regularly. You know, sort of like, really? You're going to write that down? It's going to move through the office? And you're going to start getting weird looks, you know, out of the administrative side of the street pretty soon. So, no, I don't think so. I think the hardest thing for docs in dealing with patients is to have that conversation privately. I mean, that's where you're really going to get more likelihood of truth. But on the form side itself, even when you're telling your dentist, nah, I don't believe that.
Okay, that's what I figured.
I think that's there for the purposes we were talking about earlier, a little bit of protection against malpractice.
Yeah.
Well, I did ask you.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on. Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist here. MIT scientists have just reported that this single dose of this experimental drug, and if you do it with behavioral therapy, can help at least mice so far forget traumatic experiences that occurred in the past. If this could be duplicated in human beings, this sounds to me like a great idea for people that went through war or rape survivors or child abuse survivors and stuff. Is this a good idea?
Well, let me first say, if you're a mouse, we have healthcare and interventions that will benefit you beyond belief. We can cure your cancer, eliminate your memory. So,
plus, their website is working, by the way. I don't know if you're aware.
I don't know if they Google the mice. But things in mice and rats... very interesting. Certainly want to check them for safety, but they don't always extend right away, sadly, into humans. So let's keep that as a caveat for those waiting to have the memory of their last bad meal erased.
Okay.
Now, that said, I think this is hugely ethically controversial. I can see an upside. Someone gets traumatized, sees a terrible thing, gets raped. You could imagine child abuse. You don't want to remember it anymore. It sounds good. But you take that memory away, and then someone says we're going to court to prosecute 5 years, 10 years later, so I can't remember anymore. That's trouble in terms of liability and holding people accountable. If we, so to speak, erase the horrors of Syria, then we don't have witnesses to what terrible things were done. I also think it's unlikely that you're going to go memory by memory, so you may wipe out more than you want in order to get that memory, which then starts to change perhaps our sense of who you are. Your personal identity is very much caught up with your memory. You know, I used to torture my medical students with this question. What if we could cure Alzheimer's? We could let you build new memories, but we couldn't give you back any of your old ones. Would it still be you? And would you want that?
That's a great question. That is a great question.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
What'd they say?
Most of them say they still would want it, but I don't think they're really understanding that you'd have a new person, so to speak. It's a nice thing to be able to make the new memories. I'm not against it, but the person you were has gone.
Well, you know, related to that, Art Kaplan, is many people, whether they're from a war or from a horrific sexual assault, talk about and experience that certain scene that they cannot get out of their head. They wake up in the night thinking about it. They get up in the morning thinking about it. And it's how successful are people in getting rid of those memories? I mean, you could be 60 years old and this happened to you when you were 15. You still, no one's going to be able to prosecute at that point. But you still can't get this out of your head.
Very poor. Some of those things really just linger and drive behavior and leave people dysfunctional frequently.
Yeah.
So I can see the upside. I do get it. And there may be, as you said, at some point you just say, look, we're done. We're not going to prosecute. Everybody involved with this is dead. Let's finally get rid of this memory and give you more freedom. And, you're going to have to weigh the cost and the benefit of that kind of thing. I just want to sort of give two cheers for memory. Some of the things that make us grow, some of the things that make us tougher are memories, not the worst and horrible ones. But the ones that are perhaps unpleasant, or the time we failed, or the romance that went bad, or, whatever it is, those do form our character, and they do form some of our positive drives as well.
Yeah, but some of it, and you're the last person I need to tell this to, obviously, considering what you do for a living, some of it is totally disabling.
Absolutely. I wouldn't deny that.
So one last thing on this, Art. When you were raising the concerns you voiced to Marjorie a couple of minutes ago, did I correctly hear them as more societal rather than individual, meaning that it's bad for society if a witness to something doesn't remember something? Or were you talking about a negative for the individual there? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it has social consequences. You may want to get somebody who's putting others at risk off the street, and the only way you can do it is by having that victim testify. But even for the individual, there's some sense, if you will, the memory's gone, but the physical injury of what happened to you or the burns or the disfigurement lingers. You still may want justice for what was done. Remember, there are a lot of folks who have bad experiences that are both physical and mental.
Yeah. Right.
You know, one of the things we discussed last week with our colleague Emily Rooney is a case that's generating a huge amount of controversy around the country. There was this guy, Dennis McGuire, who was convicted of raping and murdering a woman in 1989. He's about to be executed by the state of Ohio. It takes 25 minutes from the time the drugs were started till the time the death was declared. The witnesses all are talking about these movements, gasping, snorting, choking sounds, according to the New York Times account. While there's no, it's not established whether McGuire, the convicted killer and rapist, was conscious of pain. Despite that fact, his wife and his brother have filed a lawsuit in federal court saying that the treatment of McGuire, and this isn't the first time this has happened, it violates the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. Before you get your sense on this, obviously the family of the person who was raped and killed, Joy Stewart was her name, said he was treated far more humanely than he treated her, which I think is indisputable. Where are you on this? Is it cruel and unusual treatment, particularly if you can't prove that the guy who had a prolonged execution was actually in pain?
Well, let's remember the state is the one obligated not to be cruel. So we don't torture. The victims might say torture him, let him suffer a long time, and we don't care, and I understand it. The criminal justice system is going to use capital punishment, but not torture. So that's, if you're going to have it, if you're going to have capital punishment, we can debate that all day. But at least our courts have said, if we're going to do it, taking the life is what is the punishment. It's not the suffering and the pain. The problem that executions face in the few states that are still doing them is that the drugs used to do them have disappeared. They're the companies that make them, when they find out they're associated with executions, won't sell them. And so part of the problem, like this Ohio case, is the executioners are trying to come up with concoctions to kill people without causing suffering, and they don't know what they're doing. So if we're going to move forward on capital punishment, I hate to say it, but you're going to have to test some of this stuff on animals and try and make a guess, or you're going to say, that's too brutal, in which case capital punishment is going to come to a grinding halt. The presumption that you're not causing the executed person to suffer, that obligation falls on the state. It falls on us, not the critics, so to speak. You have to show that you can execute him without suffering.
Yeah, but listeners know that I don't support the death penalty, and I don't think Marjorie does either. Having said that, how odd does it sound? I think this is the reaction of most people here about this lawsuit, that you can't torture someone. We understand that. You can execute them, but you can't move towards execution in a way that may be causing them pain.
Well, hold on.
I mean, is that...
Did you read the line from the Assistant Attorney General, though, which I thought was an astounding thing to say?
In Ohio, yeah.
Yes. In the context of this whole dispute, the Assistant Attorney General there said, although there are constitutional protections, quote, you are not entitled to a pain-free execution.
Well, we don't
unquote.
Even know if he had pain to begin with. But I mean,
I don't know if that's constitutional or not.
Well, if pain equals torture, I guess is the issue.
So I guess we'd say, to be generous to the court, you're not entitled to. You don't have to experience complete lack of pain, but you can't be suffering a lot.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling the answer to this little dancing on the head of a pin, which normally I enjoy tremendously given my career activities. But I think it's really a debate about capital punishment. At the end of the day, if you worry that the whole thing is not ethical to do, that the state shouldn't be killing, and that the worst punishment you could have is to be in prison forever, not be executed, then I think the move and the shift is toward getting rid of it. And it's pretty clear that the politics of this is to claim that you're causing harm and suffering or you don't know what you're doing. I happen to think that's going to actually push the elimination of capital punishment along further. These suits who proliferate, the drugs aren't there, people don't know what they're doing. You know, it makes it harder and harder to defend.
You know, one of the great little factoids, for lack of a better expression, this piece that was in the New York Times about this, which I was unaware of. I don't know if you probably knew of it, Art. I don't know about whether Marjorie did or not. The whole issue of humane, if this is not oxymoronic, execution by the state, you know, when it moves from hanging to lethal injection. Let me read this. In 1890, electrocution was substituted for hanging in the belief that it was less painful. This is what I didn't know. But George Westinghouse and Thomas Edison both fought to keep their electrical currents out of the death chamber for the same reason that these drug manufacturers apparently are not supplying the drug that eases the pain, for lack of a better expression, leading to the lethal injection. How great is that little fact, huh?
It's great. And Westinghouse and Edison are fighting left and right not to have the electric chair powered by alternating current versus direct current. So commercial issues aside, it's clear that we've been ambivalent about capital punishment for a long time. We've tried to come up with ways. Even the guillotine was invented as a humane way to kill people. Seems kind of, horrifying to us.
Yeah.
But that's what it's doing there. So we justify it by saying, well, we've gotten the torture part out. We've gotten most of the suffering out. The more it creeps back or the more the doubt creeps back, I think it becomes hard for the state to justify doing it. So what we're really involved in here, I think, is a backdoor fight about capital punishment.
I think so, too. One last thing that I should know the answer to very quickly, Art. Federal government obviously has death penalty, even in states that don't allow the death penalty, like Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Jahar Tsarnaev, the issue is going to rise in his case, assuming he's convicted, the younger brother of the marathon bombers, the alleged marathon bombers, I guess you have to say. Is it required that a doctor be at any federal or any state execution? The answer is yes, right?
Correct.
So how is that?
Be there.
How, I assume this is past ethical muster, or it wouldn't happen. How can a doctor in that case, when people like Kevorkian are prosecuted, how is a doctor able to participate in a state-sponsored execution of somebody?
Well, the AMA says you can't.
Cannot.
The National Medical Group, and what the doctor is doing is usually pronouncing death. They're not wiring a person up to the gas or anything. So that's
and they're not they're not injecting the drugs.
Correct.
Okay.
So that's the way they
executioners carry it out, and then doctors pronouncing them. That's the fine line.
Okay. Got it.
Well, that was a cheerful discussion, Art Kaplan.
That is upbeat, yep.
Okay. Thank
Art,
you very much.
Talk,
I like Googling
always.
The doctors and doctors Googling the patients. I think we should all be Googling our doctors to beat the band.
Can you just see the patient and the doctor sitting there with their iPads, like this little thing? It's a great scene from like a Woody Allen
that's
movie
right.
or something. Art, good to talk
well,
to
you. They're both on Google Glass.
That's exactly right.
That's right. All right. Thanks so much for talking to you.
My
I love
pleasure.
To talk to you. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book called Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Thanks for joining us, Art. Coming up, GBH Arts editor Jared Bowen and Boston Globe theater critic Terry Byrne join us for a look at local theater. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3 for a look at local theater and then a very brief look at a couple of movies, our WGBH Arts editor, Jared Bowen. He's also host of the TV show Open Studio. Hey, Jared.
Hey there.
And a Boston Globe theater critic, Terry Byrne. Terry, it's been a long time. It's great to see you.
Thank
How are you?
Fun to be here.
Okay, we're going to start with a quiz. We're going to discuss four plays.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the lead character in one of these plays bears a striking resemblance to someone
you're doing this.
In this room right now. Do you know who that might be?
Oh, my goodness. I know. Can I answer the question?
Is it the misogynistic director in Venus and Fur? Is that what you're talking about, Marjorie?
Some people think I have a slight resemblance to Bernie Madoff. Is that your point, Marjorie? Is that what you're trying to say?
My point.
That
a
is
younger,
so unkind.
A younger and taller Bernie Madoff. Don't you think? There's a little bit of a resemblance.
See, I was trying to take the path of least resistance by going with misogynistic rather than Bernie Madoff.
Or is it the evil character? Is that what you're going for?
Yes. That's right. And there's actually a debate about whether this play should even be made. Let's start with you, Jared. What did you think of the Imagining Madoff?
I think that this is a fascinating piece. It's at New Repertory Theater, and it is, as the title says, it imagines this conversation between Bernie Madoff and a poet. And so you have 90 minutes of back and forth. And since we don't really know a whole lot about Bernie Madoff because he hasn't said a lot other than that quick interview that he did, the jailhouse interview, I mean, what comes out of here is some of the testimony that his secretary gave, and they actually use the actual testimony in her work. words. And then you also see you sort of imagine what might have been going through his head, the sort of any sort of morality, issues of morality, conversations, wrestling that he may have had. And of course it's controversial because we're giving voice to one of the greatest villains. And I don't mean to say that great villain, but you know, one of the most notorious, awful villains of our time. But I think it works because it forces you to consider him on a more human level.
Well, does it humanize him? That's what I think people are worried about. You on one hand, one half of your brain says, I want to know what motivates a monster like this. But the flip side is you also don't want him so humanized that you feel some empathy or sympathy. What do you leave with, Terry?
Well, what's fascinating is that this guy is a human. He's a monster in a lot of ways. But it's too easy to dismiss him as just a shallow monster. He has personality quirks. He has a lot of other things going on. And I think Jerry Kissel, who plays Madoff, really brings an enormous amount to the table. So yes, maybe you do sympathize a little bit, but maybe it's not in a positive way. Maybe you just get a little more understanding of this human being.
I read in either the Globe or the Herald review of this play, I can't remember where it was, that originally the foil for Madoff was supposed to be Elie Wiesel, who actually, I mean, not only a Holocaust survivor and obviously a very famous human being, but also a big loser because he was an investor with Madoff. And when the script was sent to him as a courtesy, Wiesel was so appalled by the thing that the writer backed off and replaced him.
But he still is he's a fictional Holocaust survivor.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically all she did was strip his name from the piece and still imagines this conversation, so he's another person. And I think it helped the play because all this controversy developed from it. But I also want to get back to your other point about do you sympathize with him or do you feel for him? Absolutely not. Terry just said Jerry Kissel, who's a great actor around town, what he does with him, you look at him, and within 2 minutes, I would say, Terry, right, of the play, you feel absolute disgust.
Right.
I mean, Jerry Kissel makes him so revolting and despicable, you absolutely abhor him because he plays him as a man who Bernie Madoff certainly was, with absolutely no remorse, no moral compass, no regard for what he was about to do.
What stage, when you say about to do, what stage in Madoff's nefarious career? When does this happen?
This is really at the end when he's been caught.
When he's been caught.
Because the Elie Wiesel character is trying to get him to represent a foundation that he's involved in, and Madoff is backing away because he's been successful at the other investments, but this is coming to a close.
What is this? This is the Watertown whatever, is it not?
What's the Repertory Theater.
What's that like? I've never been there physically. I drive by it all the time. What's it like? I mean, as a physical place, what's the deal?
Of course, they took over some of those old buildings that were part of the Arsenal complex.
Yeah.
And so New Repertory Theater is one of the resident companies there. So in one of the big buildings that they have, they've created this giant theater. And actually, it's an art space because there's the theater upstairs, a main traditional theater. And then this is in the black box space downstairs. And that's the other great part about this play is it happens in the middle of two audiences. So you're watching this unfold before you in a very intimate perspective. But they also have gallery shows in that space. It's an art center.
They have classes too, art classes.
You know, you guys are the experts on theater, obviously. That's why you're here. I know next to nothing about theater, but I wonder, when you have a play like this at this space over in Watertown, how does it work in the playwriting world? If you're maybe a lesser known playwright or you have a lesser play, you start maybe in Watertown, and if you have a blockbuster, you go on to a bigger space? Or how does that work?
Well, this play has been produced in other places. I can't remember where it started, but the playwright, I actually don't know whose choice it was, but someone reads the script and decides that this is appropriate for this space and this theater company.
So how do things get from there to to off-Broadway or even Broadway?
They succeed.
Yeah, so that's what I'm asking. Is it because of lots of people show up and it gets great reviews?
The great story about this piece is that it has been so popular that they are going to bring it back in the end of May for another additional 2-week run.
Where?
So, at the same space.
They show an audience of just victims of Bernie Madoff and get their reaction. By the way, it's playing this round through the 26th of January.
Yep.
Now, the one that I have to – we're moving on?
Well, I'm still not clear. How does a play get to Broadway is what I'm asking you.
In New Repertory Theater, they are part of a new play network. So they will identify that they go to workshops and conferences and through word of mouth, they'll find playwrights and they'll find new pieces. And then they'll give it the first treatment at New Repertory Theater. And then that's their first sense. They see what the audience reaction is. They see what the critical reaction is. And then they start to workshop it and they develop it. And they realize, well, this is a piece that can go on. This is worth pushing forward. Or they realize it's not. And so that's a lot of how these pieces germinate.
Plays from the ART have gone with great success to Broadway. I mean, right. Most recently, your favorite thing about Breaking
Bryan
Bad.
Cranston. It's not about Breaking Bad. It's with Bryan Cranston playing LBJ.
Yeah, the guy from Breaking Bad.
Yeah, it's Walter White as LBJ
is. They've been great successes at the ART, going from the ART to Broadway, right?
And what happens is you have, sorry, Terry, but they'll have producers who come in and they'll decide how viable it is. And again, paying attention to a lot of that criteria. Terry's been doing this a lot longer than I have to be able to see how
I didn't just
mean
stuck
it
her
that
tongue
way.
Out at Jared Bowen. I want to make that clear. I want the record established.
Well, a lot of small theater companies like the Lyric have a program where they develop local playwrights. So the playwrights have an opportunity to work on a script for about 9 months. And there's one local playwright named Walt McGuff who's got to have a new work premiered at New Rep in June. So there is an opportunity for new playwrights to get their work seen. Where it goes from there is a tougher road.
And I think Lydia Diamond's a great example of that, right? She was a playwright who was here in Boston for a really long time. Sadly, she just moved to Chicago, and I say sadly because she's so terrific that I hate not having her here in the city, even though one of her upcoming plays at the end of the Huntington Theater season, which you guys are going to love, it's all about Harvard scientists discovering that there's a gene that actually makes people racist. It's called Smart People. It's going to close out the Huntington Theater season.
Really?
But she's somebody who started writing works here and has just rocketed forward and has had a play go to Broadway. HBO has optioned it. It's called Stickfly. So it can happen here.
Okay, let's move on. I assume most people listening to the show right now have read The Color Purple, have seen the movie The Color Purple. When I was reading the reviews of The Color Purple, the play, and it said it was a musical, I had to read the paragraph again to make sure I didn't embarrass myself on the radio. The Color Purple as a musical? How does that work, Terry Brown?
Well, it's tough, I think. That book is so amazing and epic, and it covers this 40-year period. So putting that to music, I think it was a little harder than anyone thought it was going to be.
Give a 30-second synopsis of the story for the eight people who actually didn't read the book or didn't see the original movie. Either of you guys want to give a quick version of this thing for people?
A young girl named Celie is abused by her father. She's married off and has a couple kids. She's separated from her sister. She's abused by the man named Mister who marries her.
And then we follow this through a lifetime, basically. Perfect for a musical, I would say. I mean, I get creeps just thinking about it. How do they pull this off?
Well, it is a strange juxtaposition because Celie is a woman who lives to die. And this is how you see her on stage. She's constantly stooped. She can't make eye contact. She can't have any really valued relationships with anybody in her life because she's just meant to feel and labeled as ugly from the whole scope of her career. So then you have sort of this fluffy Broadway – you have this story, which is largely about abuse and sexual abuse, rape to some degree, and it's in this fluffy Broadway setting with these big numbers. I think staged here, Speakeasy Stage Company, has done a pretty good job in this relatively small space of making it happen. But there is a dichotomy. I mean, I like the show, but I didn't love it because I feel like it is sort of an odd treatment to give these big, lavish musical numbers to a story, which is really tough. And there are moments when I was sitting there and hearing the lyrics and suddenly thinking, oh, my goodness. I mean, it doesn't necessarily work to hear these strains, this orchestra, horrible tales of abuse.
Yeah.
There's this wonderful curtain call where the entire cast comes together and they sing this song together. And you feel all this emotion and you see this sense of community from these actors and these characters on stage. And you said, oh, why couldn't it have been like that all the way through the musical? Hmm. So there wasn't enough diversity among the music. There wasn't enough sense of emotional change. So it was a little tough. Phenomenal performances, though.
Really good. I mean, and I was struck by how emotional they were. Yeah, Terry, we sat next to each other at the opening night, and how emotional they were. I mean, tears were pouring down all of their faces because they've all just gone on this huge journey together over the course of nearly 3 hours.
Okay, now we get to misogyny, which is what you opened the whole show with here. The misogyny, we're talking about Venus and Fur, is that correct?
Venus and Fur.
What is it?
This is a 90-minute romp play back and forth between some long story short, what you have is this director who's just written this play based on a real-life novella written by the Austrian man from whom we take the term masochism. And so his play is about the interplay between men and women, and he can't find somebody to cast. And suddenly, in the stormy night, lightning, thunder, this actress comes in. She's blonde. She seems ditzy. She just wants this part, which may be about S&M, right? That's sort of her attitude, and she kind of talks like this. And then suddenly it swells into this power play between the two of them. You realize that she's way more sophisticated than she has let on. And is she playing in him? And how much can he play her back? And it does deal with S&M because she sort of strips down literally, and she's in this black leather outfit. And for the next 90 minutes, you watch them go back and forth and wrestling verbally and ideologically. It's fascinating. Although, well, I hate to give away endings, but I do not like the way that this play ended because I felt it devalued everything. Until then, it was pretty good.
But it's really funny. It's really, really funny all the way through.
It is?
Yeah.
Funny how? What does that mean?
S&M jokes, I guess that's it.
It's kind of sexy, and it's about who's really in charge and who thinks they're in control of a relationship and who thinks they're in control of directing this scene, whatever the scene is. And it's a sense of what reality are we in. You know, often you go into a play and you step into the world of the play. But in this one, you never quite knew where you were.
Jared is not sure if he sat next to you at this one, too. So can you clarify, did you sit next to Jared Bowen or did you not, Tabor?
I did not sit next
you
to him.
Not. This is at the Huntington Theater. What's this? Through February 2nd is what I understand, correct?
So it sounds like we've gotten a thumbs up for Madoff, a thumbs up for Venus and Fur, and a muted response to The Color Purple.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I heard that about Once, too, that was just playing here where my kids went to see it. And the Once was the beautiful movie and the beautiful soundtrack with the beautiful music. And they tried to make that a little bit more of a comedy, and she didn't think it worked.
I loved it for the theatrical choices that they made versus the movie.
You did? Yeah. Okay.
No, and I loved that piece. I was a huge fan of the film and loved it so much that I actually went and saw the couple who starred in the film perform. They came here.
They had a real life thing going on.
They had a real life thing, and then they toured after. They didn't last very long, which is the only sad part about it. And then I saw the show on Broadway, and I thought the show that came through Boston, which is still traveling the country, is as good as a Broadway production. It's just such a tender story, and it was dealt with well for the stage. I mean, this is something that it worked. You know, like. It's just like Color Purple, another theatrical adaptation of a well-known film. But here it worked much better.
You thought it worked.
Can I be
definitely.
Hyperbolic?
Yep.
Best movie I've seen in 10 years, even though I loved Once.
And Once was great.
And I just saw it. Isn't that what we're talking about?
Yes.
I just saw it on Broadway 2 weeks ago. It is terrific.
You know it's terrific?
It is just
okay,
totally.
My daughter has no taste.
She has no idea what she's talking about.
So we
have one more play, which I would say I'm embarrassed to say I never heard of, but of course I hadn't seen any of the movies that were nominated for the Oscars, as I told you, Jared, last week, other than 20 Feet from Stardom. We are proud to present a presentation. Terry Byrne, what's the deal with that?
Unfortunately, I did not get
to
see this
yet. Oh, perfect. There are two of us. What's the deal, Jared, with this one?
This is one of the best pieces of theater that you will see in Boston right now. It was voted one of the top 10 plays in New York last year. It's a little bit difficult to explain. Basically, it's at with the Black Box Theater, the small theater space at Arts Emerson, and you go in, and the audience is seated all around the space, and the actors are already there, and they're warming up, and they're doing their actory exercises, and you feel like you're just watching them. It's a little bit boring. And then slowly it starts to come together, and one of the actors tells you that they're going to give you a presentation about the Herero tribe of Namibia, and they were the victims of German genocide in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and they're going to tell you about this. It's going to be a lecture, and it starts off as a lecture, and it's kind of funny. They're trying to figure out how they're going to do this, and then they start to act out what was happening through letters, and you really only have this from the Germans, so you don't necessarily have it from the viewpoint of those who were killed and enslaved to some capacity in building railroads. It's made up of a cast of about 6 people. There's white man, black man, another white man, another black man. That's how they're listed in the playbill. And then suddenly you see these actors sort of disintegrate a bit because they are trying to decide how to present this and how to tell this, how to have an accent, what they're going to feel comfortable with. And you're dealing with awful, horrible, like Madoff subject matter, so that when they start to get into the racial divide and the abuses, you, as an audience member, begin to feel very, very uncomfortable because you're feeling their discomfort because this is so well directed and so well acted. I mean,
so the whole thing is of a rehearsal, essentially, is what.
Well, it starts to become a theatrical piece, and then it becomes very theatrical. You start off with the house lights up in full, and before you know it, the house lights are down, and there's this really dramatic lighting, and they've really turned a corner in what they're presenting, and you're watching a show, and you're just pulled along so brilliantly throughout until the end, which I left with my stomach in knots. I can't remember the last time I've left a theater that emotional. It's the whole arc
Sounds
of the
great.
Piece is brilliant.
And that is not a musical, we should be clear. Is that
And there's no jokes in that. Not funny.
It is funny at the beginning as they're trying to figure out how to do this. And because they're trying to create this dramatic arc, because you have to see how they go from one extreme to the next.
Okay.
Let's say, just a minute or two on a couple of movies. Last week we were sort of at opposite ends of the spectrum, Jared Bowen. We were talking about the nominations for the Oscars. I admitted that I'd only seen one movie, which was, as I said, 20 Feet from Stardom, which I totally loved.
The only one I haven't
singers.
Seen.
And, well, you hadn't seen, I thought, Fruitvale Station at the time, but I'm told you've seen it since, right?
I watched it over the weekend.
And yeah. what's your take on that?
Terrific film. It really was robbed. If people don't realize what it is, it's about Oscar Grant, who was shot to death by a transit police officer in
Oakland,
San Francisco.
California.
Yeah, in the early hours of New Year's Eve Day in 2009, and the cop claimed that he thought he was using his – he went for his taser. He really went for a gun. And so the film starts out with actual video footage because there were so many people on the subway platform who saw this happen and recorded it.
Where he's lying face down,
right,
when he's shot.
Face down. Yeah. I mean, yeah, he had already been handcuffed. There was no way he could have even resisted this arrest. So that's your starting point. And then it backs up and you get the last – speaking of emotional, I get emotional again thinking about it because it's basically the last 24 hours of his life leading up to his death. And he's somebody who really was turning a corner. I mean, he's somebody who had been in jail and who hadn't been leading the best life, had been fired. But you see how he was turning a corner, what he was dealing with to try to get his life back on track, the relationship he had with his daughter, with his mother, with his girlfriend. It is extremely powerful, and it is also very hard to watch.
Did I read somewhere that they made this for $1 million or $2 million? It was a very low production cost, which I love. I mean, the notion that real people can actually make a film for an affordable budget is pretty terrific.
From what I understand, through friends in Los Angeles, it was also a labor of love by Octavia Spencer, the Academy mm-hmm. Award-winning actress from The Help, who also plays the mother in this case. And this was sort of a passion project for her to make sure that this happened. So she leveraged what she had in terms of her fame and celebrity and attracting investors to be able to tell this story.
Yeah, I was surprised that it didn't I mean, there's 10 movies now that get nominated for the Oscars. I was surprised it didn't.
When I saw it, I was sort of horrified, actually, that it didn't. I don't understand why this film isn't among these lists because they're really good performances
and it's
really well told.
It's true. I mean, all the issues about police overreaction and arming police and young African Americans in the cities and what they go through. I mean, it just seems so relevant to. I don't get it either.
Yeah, and the takeaway is that the Hollywood elite has sort of cast it off. Are they not ready to deal with this? Because it's unlike 12 Years a Slave, which happened centuries ago. So
yes,
now we can talk about it
point.
Because this happened only a couple of years ago. We're not going to address this. It is kind of disturbing, I have to say.
Hey, Terry Brown, what's coming up in either the theater or on the screen in the next handful of months that you're most excited about?
I just do watch live bodies. I don't go to the movies.
You don't go to the movies? Wait a second. Even for your personal life?
Sometimes,
forget your career.
Yes.
So
yes.
What's coming up on the stage
well,
in the next handful of months?
Well, I saw Philomena. But I'm going to see Hairspray this
mm-hmm.
weekend.
Oh.
It's the Wheelock Family Theater, which mixes children actors and equity actors. It has Bob Saud, who I adore, who's going to play Edna Turnblad. The next thing that's coming up is the 175th anniversary of the Charles Playhouse, which is about a building, but is actually celebrating 34 years of Sheer Madness and 18 years of Blue Man Group with new
Sheer Madness. 34 years.
34 years. Next week. I know it's crazy. So, but I'm always looking forward to what's going on at the Lyric stage and whatever Speakeasy does and the Huntington.
What's on your list, Jared Bowen?
All the same, I can never remember my calendar from beginning to end. But no, I mentioned Lydia Diamond. I'm really excited about her next play because she really is somebody to watch. And right before her, I think, is Melinda Lopez, who's also a local playwright. Becoming Cuba is her play, where I think she taps into some of her ancestry and experience, family experiences to write this play. So they've got a really good season. And then the ART sees the first, I believe this is the first piece that Diane Paulus has directed since her Tony-winning Turn in Pippin. She's doing Witness Uganda. It's kind of a tough title. As she said, I think, in a recent Globe interview, it's the opposite of Book of Mormon. But that,
right.
That's a pretty good line.
She's had such a great run, Diane Paulus. It's amazing. What a career she's
had. She hasn't stumbled. I mean, in several years, it's phenomenal. And this includes directing Cirque du Soleil shows and these shows to Broadway.
She always combines, if she doesn't direct it, she finds just the right people to put it together for a production.
Yeah. And she's had many shows, as we mentioned before, go on to Broadway, correct? Yeah,
the last three that she's sent to Broadway, right, Terry, have all won the Best Tony for Revival. Porgy and Bess, Pippin, and Hare.
Hare.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, Terry Byrne, it's great to see you.
With fun.
Jared Bowen, see you in the newsroom sometime soon. Thanks to both of you guys.
Thank you.
Jared Bowen is WGBH's art editor, and he is host of the terrific television show Open Studio. Terry Byrne is a theater critic for the Boston Globe. Thank you both so much for coming in. And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with the guy who has the pulse on all the legal cases, David Frank. Edgar B. Hurwitz III also tells us about the street life of MBTA buses.
You know, we had promised you earlier in the day that that Deval Patrick would have his hour in studio tomorrow, his monthly hour, noon to one. Actually, he will be with us in studio to answer your questions and ours.
Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in.